and my fellow Pennsylvanians.
This state's electoral votes are key to who wins the presidency, and both of the candidates know it.
We win Pennsylvania, we win the whole deal. You know that.
White House versus Fed wins.
Just like last time.
But states like Pennsylvania are going to be incredibly important.
The only thing left on the board is Pennsylvania. The president cannot get to the finish line without the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
One state all four candidates are visiting today is Pennsylvania. Its 20 electoral votes are highly coveted, and the Keystone State could end up being one of the determining factors in the race.
Jill's a Philly girl, but I'm a Scranton guy.
Oh, Pennsylvania, we love Pennsylvania.
In the past, we've had other members of the Pennsylvania Congressional Delegation on this podcast, but I'm really looking forward to sitting down today at this point in the campaign cycle and in U.S. history with Congressman Brendan Boyle. As tempting as it is to talk about the Philadelphia Phillies and the season ahead, we're going to spend the next half hour talking about the seemingly never-ending saga of the federal budget-making process, prospects for Democrats flipping the House this fall, enthusiasm amongst his constituents for the Biden-Harris re-election, and knowing him, I imagine we're probably also going to touch on foreign policy. He's got great perspective on all of this. He served in Congress for a decade, and before this, he was in the State House, where he traveled the Commonwealth on behalf of the HTCC. Congressman Brendan Boyle, welcome to my kitchen table.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you for everything you've been doing for years on behalf of the great folks in Northeast Philly and the whole region and the whole Commonwealth. I so many places we could start this discussion, but you are currently the ranking member of the Budget Committee. Quite possibly a year from now, you might be the chair of the Budget Committee. But, you know, I think most Pennsylvanians, whether they care about politics or not, have known that the budget making process has been a little off the tracks in recent months in Washington. So maybe you could speak to a little of what's been happening down there.
Yeah, well, it's not exactly the prettiest sight. But first, a little bit about me. As you pointed out, yes, I was elected ranking member of the budget. So I'm the lead Democrat on the committee, was elected that last year. And so if we win the majority in November, then I would be chair of the budget committee. And I'm told that that would make me the youngest chair of any committee on Capitol Hill. And also the youngest since Paul Ryan was a chairman back about 14 years ago. So obviously it's a great honor. It also helps me because my 10-year-old daughter keeps making fun of me as being very old. And when I told her I was actually close to 50, she was aghast by this. So it's nice to be in a place where I keep being told the opposite, that I'm young. But as we know, Capitol Hill is not necessarily real life. Now, speaking of not necessarily real life, the budget and my Republican friends, they are a mess, as you've probably noticed. It has been, you know, and I've been in Congress 10 years now and was in the state legislature for six before that. So of my 16 years serving in legislative bodies, this is absolutely the most bitterly divided and dysfunctional that I have ever seen a majority party. And I served under a Democratic majority and then a Republican majority in the state House. I've served under a Republican majority and then a Democratic majority and a Republican majority again in the U.S. House. So, and I've served under Democratic governors and a Democratic governor, a Republican governor, and I've served under two Democratic presidents and a Republican president. So I have a wide variety of different types of experiences. And by far, this has been the most dysfunctional the past year and 3 months under this specific House Republican conference. It started out literally on the very first day when they couldn't elect their own leader speaker. And of course, famously, it took them 15 rounds over 4 days to elect Kevin McCarthy. And 9 months later, they booted him out by passing, for the first time in congressional history, a motion to vacate the chair for the office of speaker. So it has been with that backdrop that Republicans have attempted to push through a budget, and what has really hamstrung them is their most extreme Freedom Caucus members have the most outlandish expectations relative to reality. The Freedom Caucus and their ilk, and even those who go along with them, are barely a majority within the House Republicans. But of course, Republicans don't control the Senate. They're in the minority there, and they obviously are not in control of the White House. And yet, if you talk to Marjorie Taylor Greene and a number of Freedom Caucus members, or most extreme and most MAGA House Republicans, they cannot understand why they can't get a budget passed that achieves their very divisive, extreme agenda. And so, they came to the table, their leadership, which was then Kevin McCarthy, and reached an agreement last June. If you recall, this was the bill to raise the debt ceiling for 2 years, and at the same time set parameters on what this year's budget would be. But then immediately there was so much blowback for McCarthy internally from his loud minority, that he then immediately walked away from the deal that he'd agreed to, and literally a bill that passed the House and passed the Senate was signed into law. So the whole threat of shutdown that we've had since last June, and that just finally lifted about 6 months into this fiscal year, was really all about that. It was all about a Republican leadership really struggling to deal with reality versus the outsized expectations of their loud, most extreme minority. So for the looking prospectively at the rest of the year, I don't expect that dynamic to in any way change. Just this past week, you had the Republican Study Committee, which is a subset of House Repo it's a subset of House Republicans, but 80% of House Republicans claim membership in the Republican Study Committee, and they released a budget this past week that raises the retirement age, cuts hundreds of millions of dollars from both Social Security and Medicare, would get rid of the Affordable Care Act, and would enact a nationwide abortion ban. So when we're talking about an extreme agenda, those are the kind of things that I'm pointing to.
So with all this in mind, I mean, it seems like ages ago when we're talking about Speaker Paul Ryan, but there's a perfect example of someone who gave up a relatively safe seat at the pinnacle of American politics. We're just seeing record retirements in districts from coast to coast, largely on the other side of the aisle. And I guess I'm asking through the lens, or looking through the lens of, I mean, it's 220 some days. What's the mood in the Democratic caucus? I mean, are people counting chickens before they're hatched about reclaiming the majority? Are there certain races that you particularly are focused on? I mean, it does seem that that flipping is certainly, I mean, anything could happen in the next 220 days, but it does seem like the calculus for flipping the House is certainly there.
I've seen too many election surprises by now to in any way be overconfident about any election, including the 2024 congressional elections and presidential election. That said, when you look at the three, the presidential race, the race for control of the Senate, and the race for control of the House, I do believe that House de Democrats are best positioned when you look at all three. I think right now the control of the House is very much up for grabs, but we're probably a slight favorite. And certainly we have a better map, which of course is all of the 435 congressional districts. That presents a better map than what my friends in the Senate have on the Democratic side, where just by fluke of the calendar, the one-third of the Senate that is up this cycle happens to disproportionately be in red states over blue states by about a ratio of 2 to 1. So my Democratic friends in the Senate have to win every purple state, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, Nevada, and have to defend two red state seats in Ohio and Montana. Whereas in the House, the seats where we're on offense are in New York State and California in districts that Biden won in 2020. So fortunately, from a House Democratic perspective, we have a bit of an easier lift. But again, I think that everything is up for grabs. You know, from 2000 on, we're just in a very close, closely divided electoral reality in this country. Almost every presidential election since 2000 has been 4 points or fewer, and we have seen we've seen very few landslides in any of those races. So I fully anticipate that trend will continue in November 2024. And finally, I'll just say on the retirements, I'm actually very concerned about the kind of people who are leaving. I gave a quote to Politico 6 months ago when they asked me about this, and I said it's the wrong kind of people who are leaving. Some of the Republicans who you see retiring are actually the more serious members who aren't interested in cliques, who generally don't say extreme things, who are the kind of people who behind the scenes you can work with to reach compromises and get legislation passed, which is what I'm interested in and why I've dedicated my career to public service. Unfortunately, it's those kind of members who are getting fed up and are leaving. And it's the chaos agents, the Marjorie Taylor Greens and Lauren Boberts and those crazy types who are in no way interested in legislation, have no policy agenda, but they just want to make the no most noise. They want to get on Fox News constantly or Newsmax. Unfortunately, those folks, you know, they love the craziness. They love the chaos. So I am concerned that on the Republican side, next term could potentially even be worse, which from my perspective is yet another reason why they need to be the minority party and not in the majority.
Well, you referenced the presidential race. My recollection is literally hours after the State of the Union, you were on Air Force One with the president, along with Congresswoman Scanlon and others, coming up to Philadelphia International Airport, and then a district. I think it was in her. It was an event in her district, but I think I read somewhere that other than the Delaware congressional district, the president has visited your congressional district more than any other in the country. So you have a deep relationship with the Biden family and the Biden White House. Maybe you can, if you're comfortable, share a little of some of the anecdotes from that plane ride, and overall, your sense of the president's reelection as he's hiring a team in Pennsylvania and gearing up for, I think, a pretty tumultuous few months ahead.
You know, I'm proud and feel very fortunate to have a personal relationship with the president. I was one of his earliest endorsers when he ran in 2019, 2020, was personally out there in Iowa and New Hampshire campaigning for him. And you know, at certain points, things did not look did not look great, but we kept the faith and pulled that out, and of course pulled out the general election. Some of my House Democratic colleagues have gently teased me about the number of times I've been on Air Force One over the last couple of years. So yes, I am very fortunate that I had that relationship, and that all of us in the Philadelphia area are fortunate that we have a president who is so knowledgeable about our state, and then specifically the Philadelphia area. Frankly, it makes it much easier when I'm, you know, when I was talking to him on the phone the day after I-95 collapsed in my district, and I was telling him where exactly it was, he knew what I was talking about. It made it easy for me to make the pitch on why, you know, we needed to move heaven and earth in order to get this done so quickly. Or, I mean, we just had a big announcement a couple of weeks ago. We won one of the biggest transportation grants that have been awarded as part of this program, on reconnecting communities. I was joined by my colleague Dwight Evans. He and I have been pushing for this to essentially cap the Vine Street Expressway, which split apart Chinatown decades ago. That will help not just folks in Chinatown, but once it's done, everyone in Center City. Now suddenly you won't have one part completely segregated from the other side of the expressway, but it'll be capped and will just look wonderful and really enhance our city in so many ways. So having someone who is so familiar with our area provides a number of advantages. I'm just incredibly enthusiastic to campaign for Joe Biden's reelection. I already know that even if the presidency ended right now, this president would go down in history for some of the historic accomplishments of the things that we passed in the last several years. Truly transformative. Some of the most far-reaching pieces of domestic legislation since 1965. And I know he's going to get credit for it from the history books. Now the challenge is to make sure he ju gets just enough credit for it from the voters this November.
So let's get a little granular and talk brass tacks politics, Congressman, which I know that you're open to doing, and you know Philadelphia like the back of your hand. You just used the term enthusiastic, and we hear a lot of national talking heads talking about enthusiasm in the party, dwelling on this uncommitted movement. A lot of focus on enthusiasm in the black community. 2020 numbers, you had close to 18% in Philadelphia voting Republican. 2016, that number was much lower. 2012, it was lower. So there's a trend line. Philadelphia is obviously a Democratic city, but maybe as you're traveling the neighborhoods of your district, give listeners a sense of enthusiasm levels and what, if anything, can be done in the months ahead to change those.
Well, I mean, we're in an era, I'm not the first to observe this, but we're in an era of negative polarization where a lot of people on the right are heavily motivated to vote against the other side, and the same applies to those on the left. That said, though, as 2016 showed, as 2018 flipping the House showed, and 2020 showed, there still are swing voters. There were people in 2016 in Pennsylvania who voted for Trump, even though they had voted for Barack Obama twice. By one estimate, approximately 11% of the electorate of Pennsylvania, 11%. One out of every nine voters in Pennsylvania voted for Obama and then switched to vote for Trump. Well, a number of people voted for Trump in 2016, then voted for Biden in 2020. You especially saw that in Erie County and in Northampton County. As well as some parts of Philadelphia. But you have also had this trend in some cities, and not just cities, but it's more pronounced there, where you have had specifically among Latino voters a drop off, and Trump did quite a bit better in 2020 than he did in 2016. You saw this in a number of heavily Puerto Rican wards in North Philadelphia, literally a double digit improvement for Donald Trump in 2020 over 2016. It actually, I think, has been one of the less reported aspects of that election. And so, yes,
Double
you saw
digit,
that.
and
Sorry?
that's double digit, and that's
Double
after
digits.
the throwing of toilet paper after Hurricane Maria down there on
Incredible.
the island.
It's incredible and hard to understand. But you saw the same thing, by the way, in Springfield, Massachusetts, where there's a large Puerto Rican population. You saw the same thing in South Florida, where there's a large Cuban, but also Venezuelan and a Colombian population. You saw it in South Texas, and you're continuing to see it. And you saw it in California as well. So this is not just any one specific Latino community, which is quite diverse. It's wider than that, and it's more than just one city. So we have that going on. And I've talked to a number of my colleagues in the Hispanic caucus about it. They know it's real, and they're working very hard to attempt to improve our numbers there. And there are some early indications through polling that things that trend line is continuing. And so that's concerning. You also have this issue in which not just in Philadelphia, but in Milwaukee, Detroit, a number of other bigger cities, you have seen a small but gradual decline in African American turnout. Yeah, 2016 was lower than 2012, just somewhat understandable given Obama was on the ticket in 12, but then that continued in successive elections. So my view in Philadelphia, we still have work to do in order to build back up some of those numbers. But it's not just Philadelphia. I mean, it has been an issue in a number of cities when it comes to Democratic enthusiasm. So I look at it as a project that we need to take seriously and address. I know a number of people who are working on this issue right now. The good news, though, is increasingly in areas outside of the city where we used to, where Democrats used to not do well, we have been increasingly doing well. So, the reality is, with every election, there's a shift in certain coalitions, and none of these parties are static. And so we are seeing them evolve rather. It's just that we happen to be at a time and place in American history in which just a half a percentage point can make the difference between losing and winning. Half a percentage point was the margin by which Trump won Pennsylvania in 2016, and 1.2% is the margin Biden won Pennsylvania in 2020. So at margins like that, any little thing can make the ultimate difference.
Hey, look, we're a Pennsylvania political podcast, but I'm reminded in Michigan in 2016 it was less than 11,000 votes.
Right.
That's a few condo buildings in Philadelphia. In Wisconsin, it's perpetually under 24,000 votes. I want to unpackage what you said as we wind down with kind of two lenses. The first, I've seen this in your district, I've seen this elsewhere in the Commonwealth, that you'll have. I won't call out which labor locals, but you'll have a bumper sticker of a proud union member on a UAW made often pickup truck, and then you'll have a Trump Pence bumper sticker. So you have a great relationship and you've got a deep knowledge of the working men and women of organized labor. And maybe you can speak to a little of those trends in recent years that you've seen.
Well, organized labor is pretty diverse. I mean, you have the building trades, and even within the trades, you have some that differ from some others. And then, of course, you have the government sector unions, and then some others like SEIU, say, and Unite Here, that are more in the service industry. So it actually is quite difficult to paint unions with the same broad brush. I would point out that for those labor unions, let's say the trades, that aside from the laborers skew overwhelmingly white male, if you look at white males in the rest of Pennsylvania or white males nationwide, they obviously are a solidly Republican constituency. And yet, when you look at the Philadelphia area, Democrats do marginally a lot better among white unionized males. So when you look at it from that context, it shows you the enormous difference that unions can make. You were still going to have, some union members who, let's say, like a lot of other voters, will vote the social and cultural issues over the economic issues. That's not unique to union members. I know a number of incredibly affluent suburban Philadelphians who are in the upper rungs of the tax bracket who will tell me that they wouldn't mind Republican tax cuts, but they're voting Democratic because they just care a lot more about certain cultural issues and social issues. Well, guess what? The same thing happens on the other side. There are certainly a large number of people in places like Fayette County and other parts of Pennsylvania that I would offer are voting against their economic self-interest, but culturally they feel more connected to the Republican side and message than the Democratic side. So that is going on. I mean, just being a member of a union doesn't make you immune from those larger societal trends. But overall, when you compare where union members in the Philadelphia area are versus the same demographic, but not in a union, you do see a dramatic difference and a much greater likelihood of voting Democratic. Last thing I'll say is about 6, 7 months ago, Labor Day, I was downtown Penn's Landing. Yes, Joe Biden was again in Philadelphia in my district, speaking at the Labor Day parade and the kickoff event before the parade. Diverse crowd, but it was certainly much more white and male, say, than a typical crowd. And it was overwhelming enthusiastic support for Joe Biden. And that really speaks to the power still of labor unions in and around southeastern Pennsylvania and the state.
Well, I'd encourage listeners, we've had a lot of good conversations with great labor leaders across the Commonwealth, and I get data each week, and we do have listeners in Fayette County. Ironically, the county seat's called Union Town, and we have listeners
I
there.
have
So.
been there multiple times, by the way, and I'm proud to say in 2012, when I was a state legislator, I was helping three Democratic state reps. And in 2012, we won all three seats. All three incumbent Democratic state reps got reelected. They were very popular in their districts. The top of the ticket wasn't necessarily going well, but I'll never forget in Fayette County, that Democratic dinner in 2012 drew 400 people that I attended. So it convinces me we as a party should not be giving up on any single county in Pennsylvania. There are two kinds of voters: those who vote Democratic, and those who aren't voting Democratic yet. And that, I believe, is the attitude that we should have.
Well, that segues into my final question, which unpackages a bit about what you were saying with the president's reelection. I'd venture to guess that your district is certainly the most diverse in the congressional delegation in PA. I'd venture to guess it's probably one of the top 7 to 10 in the country, just with the number of languages that are spoken around constituents' household kitchen tables. You through your campaigns, you have a deep understanding of ethnic organizing. You alluded to the different Latino communities, but do you get a sense that, is the DNC and is the campaign going and targeting Eastern European versus South Asian versus Latino? What level of micro-targeting and engagement is happening in this 7 month sprint ahead?
Yeah, well, I think, Ari, you know my passion for this issue, because first, just to orient folks.
Oh yeah, we could have a whole podcast about foreign policy with Congressman Boyle, who probably knows as much about European capitals as our own capital, so.
Well, so just for folks' awareness, so I used to represent a district that was part in Philadelphia, part in Montgomery County. It changed dramatically in 2018, and so for the last 5, 6 years, I've represented a district that's entirely within the city of Philadelphia. It's approximately one half of the city, from the far northeast all the way as far south as Society Hill. And in terms of racial and ethnic diversity, the top line figures, I like to say it's roughly 40, 30, 20, 10. What I mean is about 40% white, 30% black, 20% Hispanic, 10% Asian. But that's just the surface of it, because even within that, just look at the white population, for example. I have a large and growing Eastern European first generation immigrant community. Originally, Russian Jewish families in the 80s that came over. Then it was a much more broad kind of former USSR population, a very large Ukrainian population, one of the largest in the country. But Moldovan, Belarus, et cetera. And then, of course, you have a more kind of traditional, multi-generational Western European, heavily Catholic population, same heavily kind of Western European Jewish population that's, say, second or third generation. And so that's the diversity just among the white population. And then the Asian diversity is enormous. And you also have a rising, growing African immigrant population in certain corners of my district. So it's diverse in the truest sense, and really each community has to be you have to have a personal relationship with individually, because while we might artificially attempt to group people together under a certain heading, I haven't spoken to too many people who actually self-identify in that way. Now, to your question about, how much do they vote on foreign policy? And as you know, Ari, I serve as part of the U.S. delegation to the NATO Parliament. I've been in the leadership of that organization as chair for the last 6 years now. I was literally in Brussels 2 years ago when Putin's brutal invasion of Ukraine commenced. Just last month, I was at the Munich Security Conference and meeting with Zelensky. I have been very much involved in these conversations and negotiations right now over a Ukraine bill, something we desperately need. I do think there will be some voters in my district, especially Ukrainian Americans, who before 2016 used to lean right, who will be voting on foreign affairs issues and will be voting Democratic specifically because of them. There are other ethnic communities who also may vote on foreign affairs issues. If there is something really active going on about, their one or two big issues. For most voters, however, we tend to be domestically focused. One of Mark Twain's many famous quotes is, "America's two best friends in the world are Miss Atlantic and Mr. Pacific." So even though I don't agree actually with that sentiment, I'm much more kind of international in my focus. It shows you, though, that sort of isolationist streak has always been active in American politics, and especially on the populist front. And we are having to once again confront that right now, unlike any time really since the 1930s. I've been struck by the fact there are some small voices on the far left that have attempted to use against me my strong advocacy for the U.S. leading NATO and U.S. funding of our Ukrainian allies. And of course, there have been a whole bunch of people on the MAGA far right who have attacked me for the same thing. I am proud to defend the foreign policy and national security interests of the United States. I think it's one of the most important issues on the ballot this November. And it's something that, whether in the majority or the minority after November, I will continue to work on. And it's been pointed out to me that, maybe I'm sort of unique in that regard, that typically, members of Congress from Philadelphia have been more domestically focused. I think that you can do both at the same time. You can still be active on the economic and domestic issues and fight for labor unions and the working men and women who comprise them, yet at the same time recognize we're in a very dangerous moment in the history of the Transatlantic Alliance and the history of the world. And what we need now is a strong, actively involved United States.
Well, amen to that. That's a good note to end on. And thank you for being so actively involved in just bettering the lives of Philadelphians and Pennsylvanians. Appreciate the time and perspective.
This was wonderful. Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Pennsylvania Kitchen Table Politics. Take a minute and leave us a rating and review on your podcast platform. Please also consider following us on social media for updates and announcements regarding future episodes and new guests. You're political, so I am sure that you're on Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram. We are too, at PA Political Podcast. Visit our website, papoliticalpodcast.org, and send us your feedback about this episode and suggestions on future guests. Until next week. Thank you.